From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, why R. Kelly is pocketing more royalties for his music, even as he awaits trial on sex abuse charges. Then we hear from the creators of a concert series where songwriters are challenged to write a song about a given subject on the spot.
We're playing these weird, funny, sometimes amazing, sometimes really terrible songs. I think what it does is it takes you back to the really pure reason you wanted to be a musician and songwriter.
And the story of a man who went from being homeless to becoming one of today's most prolific TV composers. All that on The Frame. Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Last Friday, the singer and producer R. Kelly was arrested on 10 counts of aggravated sexual abuse. He posted bail and is due back in court on March 22nd. After several women shared stories of Kelly's sexual, physical, and mental abuse in the cable series Surviving R. Kelly, his record label, RCA, said that it was parting ways with the singer, yet Kelly is still making money for his music. In a recent article in Rolling Stone, music business writer Amy Wong cited a Nielsen report that shows R. Kelly's music streams had nearly doubled in the days following the Surviving R. Kelly premiere. When we spoke, Wong explained why dropping an artist in the modern streaming age is not so simple.
So it goes back to the sort of peculiar nature of the way we listen to music nowadays. In the CD era, you supported an artist by buying their physical CD, or even in iTunes, you would buy it digitally. Now you stream it, which means that they're getting your attention, positive or negative. So if, for instance, you were someone who hasn't listened to R. Kelly in 10 years, you saw the news and you were sort of just curious, you know, what does R. Kelly sound like? I forgot. Or what was his big song? And you streamed it. You're actually unintentionally making money for R. Kelly because those royalties are being paid out by a streaming service like Spotify.
And then when the label splits with an artist, they don't really just get out of the business entirely, right? There are still deals. They're still publishing. The artist is still making money through the label or the publishing arm. Is that right as well?
Yeah, that is right. So in the streaming era, it's a little bit tricky to say that you actually dropped an artist because there's no, you know, consensus on what that actually means. Previously, if you dropped an artist, it would be the end of their career. They might not ever get any money again because no one will release their music. However, even if R. Kelly never releases any other music in the future, he's still making money off of what's called the back catalog, which is the music he's already released from RCA that is now on streaming services, which will continue to be streamed and profited off of.
So an obvious kind of comparison would be a publisher who says they're not going to publish works from a novelist. That novelist has maybe a dozen books at the publisher. Bookstores call up and say, we need another 100 copies, and they send them off. So they're not working in the future with a novelist, but they're still selling books as a record label would sell streams or music publishing or even CDs.
That's right, yeah. And that's sort of the problem with the idea of dropping someone. You can sort of applaud a record label or a publisher for that matter and say they're doing the right thing, but ultimately it's more of a virtue signal than anything because they're saying they won't do something in the future while maintaining that profit stream from someone's past.
So before any of these new developments happened, Spotify last year took R. Kelly's music and the music of XXXTentacion from its playlist, and it received a lot of criticism and backlash, and Spotify later retracted those removals. How are music platforms trying to figure out what they can and should do with artists like R. Kelly, and how are they trying to enable listeners to be able to limit access to artists like R. Kelly?
It's a really tricky and unique situation, what Spotify did, which was attempt to do something very well-intentioned. So they wanted to not support R. Kelly, but it came off as, Spotify saying that they want to judge people on their moral character, regardless of everything else. So what they did instead recently was they launched a mute feature in beta, which means that a user can go through and click mute on any artist they don't want to automatically play in playlists. Doesn't mean that the artist just disappears. That means that if I'm using Spotify and his name is on a certain playlist I pick, it'll just skip that song. His name will still be there and I can still find him if I really need to, but it'll just skip automatically coming into my ears. So that's one way of sort of getting around it. However, the bigger question is whether streaming services should be taking any sort of stance outside of distribution, which is what they purportedly do. A record store, for instance, in the CD era, would never suddenly decide that they don't want to stalk a person and then make a huge judgment and not allow people to buy that CD anymore. So the question is, should Spotify, as a tech gatekeeper, be doing that sort of thing? Should the labels be doing that sort of thing? Or should anybody at all be putting a moral spin on what people listen to?
I'm not sure there's anything morally wrong with a private business saying we're not going to stock R. Kelly's music in our record stores or on our streaming services. And by that extension, I wonder if the record label was really willing to wash its hands of R. Kelly, could they suspend every part of their business with him or their contracts in place that they would run afoul of?
In an artist contract, typically there are a number of albums, especially for big artists, that are planned for the future. For instance, R. Kelly's contract may have said, you know, we still expect 3 albums in the future. And in that case, the label would have had to pay a certain amount of money traditionally to an artist to sort of let them go from the contract. So that may have happened. We don't really know the terms of the deal. But what's clear is that money has to change hands somehow if an artist is let out of a contract or let go from one. So you're right. It is mainly, at the end of the day, it's a financial issue for the labels, for the publishers, and for services like Spotify, who have to weigh that with the idea of corporate responsibility, which is another issue that has been sort of bubbling up in the last year or so.
And if R. Kelly wanted to, could he do it himself? Could he start somehow his own streaming service, release his own music independently, assuming that he's not convicted and going to jail?
He could actually, if he wanted to, release music independently, which is the beauty and the curse in many ways of the modern streaming age, because it's so easy to put out music and get it distributed through a do-it-yourself distributor and just sort of get it onto Spotify or Apple Music automatically like that. You don't actually need to go through a record label. The question is whether anybody will listen to it or whether you would be able to build up an audience without the resources a record label provides, which includes, of course, studio time, marketing, all those resources that artists typically get as part of a record deal, which is why record labels are still important. But of course, if you're someone as big as R. Kelly, you might just have the money yourself and be able to do it. So if he does release new music, that'll be an interesting question for listeners, because they'll have to be making an active decision to go listen to R. Kelly.
Amy Wong is the music business reporter for Rolling Stone. Amy, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, John.
Coming up on The Frame, a concert series about the songwriting process rather than the song itself.
It's about time I said hello to all those lonely people. The ones at the back who could never talk back through all their tears.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Most of the time when we go see a concert, we expect the songs already to be written, rehearsed, and arranged into a set list. But what if you based a show around the songwriting process itself?
Hi, good evening, everybody. So welcome to the Theatricum Botanicum and to Song Club.
A few months ago, I moderated an event in Topanga Canyon called Song Club. It's an LA-based performance and conversation series hosted by songwriters Inara George and Eleni Mandel. Under the giant oak trees of the Wheel Gear Theatricum Botanicum, 10 songwriters took a turn at the mic to share songs they'd recently composed. Some were finishing their tunes just before taking the stage. The songwriters were given just one prompt.
Either write a song that sounds happy with sad lyrics, or a song that sounds or feels sad with happy lyrics.
The performers were of different ages and backgrounds, each with their own unique style. When I spoke with Inara George and Eleni Mandel before the event, Mandel began by telling me how Song Club evolved.
So I was teaching songwriting at 2 colleges and a prison, and I would tell friends of mine and mutual friends of ours, oh, I gave these students the craziest idea. Like, ha, 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 I can't believe what I made them do. And every time I told the story to a musician that's already working making records, they'd always say, oh, I wish I could take a class like that. So I decided to start a club, and I invited a few people, and, you know, once every couple of months, I'd give an assignment, or our friend Alex Lilly gave an assignment, one of the worst and hardest and most exciting assignments, write a political dance song.
And then there's so many.
And then we'd get together and play them for each other and talk about them.
Is the idea to come out of this process with something, or to come out of it with a new way of working or thinking about songwriting? What is the end goal, I guess?
I feel like the end goal is to just exercise that creative muscle. And if you get it wrong, or if you hate it, or if you're embarrassed by it, or if it's amazing, no matter what, it's a worthwhile exercise.
I think sometimes as a songwriter, you can get so precious about everything you do, and to have a thing where it feels like a club and you're doing your best and you bring a song and it maybe doesn't even fit what the assignment was, it's like you still made it happen.
Yeah. And then hearing when everyone has the same assignment and then you hear how many different ways that was interpreted, it's really, really fun.
A couple people were talking about like method of writing and do you stew on it or ruminate? I just let it rip. I'm spacing out as I slice up these unripe bananas. Look, there goes Satan with Mike Tyson and Tony Montana. It's been a hell of a week. We've seen too many things we can't unsee.
It's just sort of funny and fun, and everyone has a good time. It's one of the best ways to have a party. Because, you know, we're eating, we're having some wine, and then we're playing these weird, funny, sometimes amazing, sometimes really terrible songs, just having fun doing it. In a way, I think what it does is it takes you back to the really pure reason you wanted to be a musician and songwriter.
I think adding the audience might, I don't know, it might actually make it even more fun, because it's, you're kind of, you're just like, okay, I'm walking out in my underpants, and let's hope this let's hope it works.
Discombobulated in the backyard, I can't help singing, you're acting suspicious.
And I said singing, but it's saying.
I did think when I started doing it, I thought, I feel like people would be really interested in seeing what this is like. Someone who isn't a musician, to hear all the mistakes or the genius and all the different varieties.
I think there's an assumption that younger, less experienced musicians have a lot to learn from people who have been in it for a long time. But I just know from talking to veteran actors who are often cast against non-professional first-timers, that the veterans end up learning as much from the newbies as the other way around. Have you found that to be true as well?
Absolutely. I invited Richard Moore, who was a former student of mine. He's 21 years old, and he listens to such different music than I listen to, and writes so differently than I do.
I spent the summer writing songs about my lover. I don't think they'll ever know. I spent the summer buried deep inside my covers, too afraid to touch my phone, and I fall like cherries in the spring.
I feel like I definitely learn and get inspired by hearing what younger people are doing, because I've been doing what I do for so long, it's hard for me to break out and try something different.
And I invited Bella Porter, and I saw her at this crossroads. I mean, she was a senior in high school. This was 2 years ago. So she's, I don't think she's legal yet to drink. And she blew me away.
Spent the day at the museum. Laughed so hard at all the artifacts.
I had such a kind of like blind confidence when I was younger. And it's so exciting to see that in younger people.
And how do you avoid the kind of open mic night issue, which is that if you go to an open mic night with comedians who are trying to break it, every comedian is rooting for the other person to fail so that they look better. How do you make sure that everybody is rooting for everybody to do great work? Is it how you cast it?
I feel like it's such a supportive community.
And comedians are dark. I'm sorry,
yeah,
right?
Musicians are really, really
musicians
uplifting.
Are more, but it's more collaborative. You're in bands. Yeah. You're playing music together all the time. So I think you, it's like it's ingrained in you to root for someone.
I also feel like at the clubs that we've done privately, everyone, you know, will say like, oh, yours was so good. Mine was the worst. No, mine was the worst. Yours was the best.
My friends all call me.
What about yourselves? I mean, you have challenged yourself to come up with something following the prompt.
Yeah.
How much do you worry about, like, what you have to do? And are you able to kind of relax and just say, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. The chips are going to fall wherever they're going to fall.
I definitely think my song is very, very cheesy. And I think that it could make me a lot of money someday, especially on the wedding circuit.
I'm going to slow it down so it gets sadder.
I think what I like best about writing for an assignment is that you can be totally free to make a fool of yourself. And it's just, and you can just say, it was an assignment, it was an exercise. I don't think that I'll necessarily put this song on a record, but if it's terrible, it might be more fun.
I never thought I'd be loved like this. Oh, love so big.
I don't know if I really accomplished the assignment, but I tried. Really tried. Put my best foot forward.
And also, this is something I just wrote. I finished it this morning, so it could get a little rough around here.
What should we say to our sons and our daughters?
Now that I'm doing the assignments, I used to give them to students and then just be like, come on, make it happen, do it right. And now I realize that, wow, that's really hard. It's amazing to jump through hoops very quickly like that.
Songwriters often have a lot of difficulty explaining their creative process because sometimes it's something that they don't understand themselves. And kind of the nature of this conversation is they have to talk a little bit about how they come up with a lyric or a melody. Is that part of the challenge as well, to understand your own creative process and share it with people so that they understand how your creative mind works?
I think that's one of the benefits of it, is that when you're writing as self-consciously as you have to, because usually for me, I'm inspiration only. I don't try. I wait until the inspiration hits and then I write. So having to try and having to follow these parameters makes you think about, in this metacognitive way, how you work, what works, you know, like how you make something better if you don't like it, when do you know you're finished, all of those things.
Because this was an assignment, I'm grateful to say that I also felt licensed to use the word love, although a bit bitterly, in this song.
I don't know, Eleni's in the same boat, because she has two kids, but after having kids, I found I needed to give myself assignments so I could finish a song.
This is called To a Hammer, Everything Looks Like a Nail.
The muse does hit you occasionally, but when you've got to go to grocery shopping, it really kind of gets shoved to the side. So
that's true.
So I do, like, I give myself deadlines.
If you wanna be lied to, broken down, left on the ground, you could try love.
Nara and Eleni, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The next edition of Song Club is slated for March 24th at the Hayworth Theater in Los Angeles. Coming up on The Frame, a prolific TV composer who was once homeless.
If you want to cry more than you ever thought you could, you might want to try.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Who are the homeless that you pass in L.A.? Panhandling at traffic lights, sleeping on the street, trying to survive any way they can. Well, they're all people just like us, and they all have stories about what led them to lose pretty much everything that the rest of us enjoy. At last count, there were more than 55,000 homeless men and women in L.A. County, and if you'd passed one particular homeless man walking up and down Melrose Avenue in the late 1980s, you might have unknowingly crossed paths with a musician who had become the composer for dozens of popular TV shows over the past 30 years. Frame contributor Tim Grieving has his remarkable story.
Kurt Farquhar is probably an unfamiliar name. But if you've watched any TV since 1989, you've heard his music. He's the composer of Sister Sister, Moesha, The King of Queens, and he currently has multiple shows on the air, including The Neighborhood and Black Lightning. He's written more music for TV than any other African-American composer, both under his own name and through his True Music production house. But when he first moved to LA in 1986, he ended up living on the street for more than a year.
Everybody that lives on the street isn't insane, isn't a drug addict. Talk to folks. I'm now hearing more stories about so-and-so in that year they spent in their car. If I had a car, that would have been me.
We're standing on Melrose Avenue near the La Brea intersection, right where Farquhar often used to sleep. Not exactly the California dream.
We're doing something crazy. We come out here from all around the country, all around the world, to think that we're going to be that one person that succeeds in music. I mean, it seemed perfectly logical to me then, but it's a once-in-a-lifetime ride, you know, and not everybody gets it. And a lot of things can happen on the way.
Farquhar grew up on the south side of Chicago.
They had created a whole music department inside a high school, and you could take music all day long, music theory, music history. You could be in either the orchestra, the band, or choir. I had an orchestra at my disposal to write for as a child, and I'd write this really complex, either jazz pieces or classical pieces, and I'd just get infuriated that they couldn't play. Well, would I play it exactly right? And the teacher said, "Kurt, these are kids." I said, "I'm a kid. I can do it."
With his parents' help, Farquhar studied music at a university in Illinois and the National Conservatory for Music in Versailles, France. Then his brother Ralph suggested he come out to Los Angeles.
And he and his wife were going to New York. He says, "Well, you can come and stay at our place." So I did, and that's how I ended up in L.A. with $136 in my pocket.
Farquhar made some music out here, but not much money. Then his brother fell on hard times, too. And because Farquhar didn't want to admit defeat or ask his parents for help yet again.
I ended up homeless on the streets, walking up and down Melrose. My life at that point probably was a slow-moving car wreck, and this ended up, things weren't good. And I just didn't understand how I could be there. I remember just thinking that, oh, this wouldn't last long. This wouldn't last long, and a year later, you're still there.
As we walked around this neighborhood, Farquhar shared his techniques for life on the street.
I would go to a place and act like I was going to rent an apartment, and I would always leave a window open, and then I'd come in there. It had to be a place with carpet. And I would come in and crawl in the window at night and sleep on the carpet. I'd wash myself up in there in the morning, and then I'd leave. I'd always lock the window so I couldn't come back again. I would just do it the one night, and it just made me feel better. So it's one of these apartments, right? There's that apartment on the other side of the alley there, right there, is where I used to do it.
Farquhar's big brother, Ralph, had become a TV writer, and in 1989, he was working on a new comedy called Livin' Large. He told his kid brother that he should try out for the theme song.
I said, "It pays?" He said, yeah, it'll pay if you can get it. And so I went out for it.
Farquhar's theme song for Livin' Large got accepted. The show didn't get picked up. But around that time, he got a small record deal. It didn't pay much or really go anywhere, but he finally got an apartment.
Busted.
One day, he was surfing TV channels and saw that the comedy pilot for Livin' Large was airing, thanks to a writer's strike. He called up the show's producer.
"Sir, I was just wondering, the show was on TV with my music. Do I get paid for that?" He said, yeah, sure. I said, "Well, how much would that be?" He said, "Well, it's an end title. We could probably make a deal for about $10K. I said, $10,000? Exactly when would I get that $10,000? I cast it, got it all in cash in 20s and 10s. And I literally, honestly, tossed it up in the air and was rolling around on it on my apartment floor. I said, "I'm going to see what it means to go after everything, to do everything, and to be the best that I can be at this." And that year got better. And then the next year got better. My third year in, I had a breakout year where I picked up 9 different shows. And it's been, from that point on, it's been a pretty interesting ride. I haven't had less than 5 shows in production in a given year since then. to be back here, knowing that I was walking these streets, and then to see a billboard on the same street with a show of mine that's currently the number one new show on CBS is quite a journey.
That show, The Neighborhood. This story is dedicated to Beth Krakauer, Kurt Farquhar's publicist who brought me this story and who died from breast cancer in September before she had a chance to hear it. For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
And that's our show for today. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.